Sashin has continued to move forward, doing its Sashin thing, carrying us along with it. Today's Teisho is number 3472 in the ongoing series about failure. And today, sharing with me in the failure will be James. He and I will share this talk. So before I start to go on about failure, I want to read a few things to you, tell you a little story, make some remarks, and then I'll hand it over to James. So that should be in a few hours. All of the precepts have commentaries that are attributed to Bodhidharma, and we attribute the second set of commentaries to Dogen. Yasutani actually attributes them to Dogen's teacher. I'm going to read Bodhidharma's and Dogen's comment on the ninth grave precept. This is what Bodhidharma says. Self-nature is subtle and mysterious. In the realm of the selfless Dharma, not contriving reality for the self is called the precept of not indulging in anger. And here's Dogen's comment. Not advancing, not retreating, not real, not empty. There is an ocean of bright clouds. There is an ocean of solemn clouds. And then here's the precept itself in our version. Transforming suffering into wisdom, I vow to take up the way of not indulging in anger. So I want to title this talk. I want to call it, I want to actually quote a student of the great contemporary Zen master, Joshu Sasaki Roshi. Most of you know him as Leonard Cohen. And the quote is, "That don't make it junk." So this is the "that don't make it junk" talk. We've been talking for a while here about meeting what's present, the arising of life in the form of suffering and life in the form of joy. The arising of life as it is. And as Bodhidharma warns us in that Bodhidharma way of saying the same thing many, many times, not contriving reality for the self. This is this most important piece about this teaching in my book, not contriving reality for the self. Here's Leonard Cohen's commentary on it. I fought against the bottle, but I had to do it drunk. Took my diamond to the pawn shop, but that don't make it junk. I know that I'm forgiven, but I don't know how I know. I don't trust my inner feelings. Inner feelings come and go. So this is a pointer to the work of being a person of Zen.
Can you speak louder, please?
Did you miss the whole thing?
No, just parts of it.
Oh, well. You know, I'm going to suggest that people behind the fireplace could move their seats a little forward. Maybe you can hear better. Could you hear me say that? How's that? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Helps.
Yes. So contriving a reality for the self. This is the essential problem. Thinking that I am a person who is a big problem. Not understanding that there's an ocean of bright clouds and an ocean of solemn clouds is a big problem. That feelings come and go. Our work in Zen is not to trust what comes and goes, only to trust that everything does come and go. This is a really important differentiation. It's not that we're a sangha of losers, a sangha of failures. We're really a sangha of human beings. We're a sangha of people who have decided, after trying everything that they could think of, every strategy, every self-help manual, every course, every class, have decided that the only way to go on is to turn towards what's real in the moment, not because it's something that's trustworthy in itself, but because it's the only thing that we can know now. So Zen is not a practice of speculation. It's not a practice of trying to figure out the reasons for everything. Leonard Cohen says, "I know I'm forgiven, but I don't know how I know." This is a pointer as well. To really understand that we don't have to understand everything is a very important part of this work. What this allows us to do is to have a kind of a freedom, a kind of a way of encountering sorrow when sorrow arises, of encountering fear when fear arises. And this allows us to encounter joy when joy arises, instead of walling off, trying to be something other than what we are. We've decided that we're going to be with what is here, whatever that might be. But not to contrive a reality for it. Not to say, sadness is arising, that makes me a sad person. But instead to realize that when sadness arises, that's just sadness arising. When I was a little girl, I used to sing and play the piano a lot. I had a little toy piano. I grew up to have a bigger piano and sing in bigger venues. When I was a little girl, I had no hesitation at singing at the top of my lungs and entertaining everyone. But when I was older, I was very shy and scared to entertain everyone with my voice. And so I held it in front of every performance. I would shake inside. There would be terrible feelings in my belly and my chest. I called them terrible, but they weren't really terrible. I just named them that in my ongoing effort to contrive a reality for myself, which said, I am this kind of person. So my stomach jumped up and down, and I had heat in my chest, and I felt shaky. And I was lucky enough to have an uncle who was a vaudeville performer. Some of you have heard about him before, my Uncle Al. And some of you know this story, that I asked him for advice. He was in his 80s at the time. He ended up living to be 99 years old. And I said to him, Uncle Al, what should I do about my fear, my anxiety. I'm such an anxious person. Before I go on stage, I just get so upset. How can I get rid of my fear and anxiety? And he looked at me genuinely puzzled, and he said, why would you want to get rid of it? That's what gives your performance pizzazz, life. And it was really my first Zen lesson in this same teaching. A person who decides that we're going to live inside of some limited self-definition is a person who is trusting inner feelings, not remembering that they come and go. It's helpful in the short term because it was helpful to anticipate fear before a performance. And still, before a talk like this, I still can feel that little shake in my belly and my chest and my arms shaking. And when I was told I didn't speak loud enough, I had to recover myself because the same forces went through my body. And then the danger is that the voices come in and they say things like, you're just an anxious person. You're a bad teacher. You don't know how to give Dharma talks. You don't know how to play or sing. The little girl who played and sang didn't have those voices. They developed later. And the work of Zen is to be very suspicious about them, to come back to the essential thing, and then to open our mouths and say whatever there is to say.
We're in a kind of fortunate place, at least I feel I am. I sit here and I look out at all of you, and there is this lovely reality. I close my eyes and I immediately start rimming. I start dreaming. It's that time of Sesshin. And that invitation list tells us to turn into reality, to turn and look, is mitigated a little bit for me at this moment by the realization there are multiple realities. For me, open eye, close eye. Chuang Tzu's butterfly. I'm dreaming it's a person. We are invited here to engage the precepts as gates, as ways in. We're invited here to engage our weaknesses and wounds and hurts as a way in. I am endlessly fascinated by self-esteem issues. In fact, they're not my issues. As I hear the stories of not getting grades good enough, or the fear of failure and these other things, I am personally, well, there's two parts to me. One is I am that person who, if you, if I would walk around to the back of the house and step in horseshit, I would immediately look for the pony. I am just basically an optimistic individual. But there's something else as well, and I think it's kind of a class thing, at least in our reality. I mentioned before how Diane Rossetto and I would be at Zen teacher conferences where we were literally the only people not raised in the middle classes, American middle classes. And we would listen to people talk about often the very same stories we're hearing here about not feeling good enough and not feeling up to the task. And I'm ashamed to say we would laugh at you all. For us, the questions were, as we saw it, more basic about survival. And there is actually, there's another story that you've heard before. I'd heard it from Diane. It's in her book, Waking Up to Who You Are, another reflection on precepts, in which she was pregnant in high school. gave birth to the baby, dropped out, and was struggling to survive. And she saw at some point that there was a job opening for a legal secretary. And even though she knew very little about such highfalutin things, she got it. She understood that legal secretaries were paid pretty well. And so she went and applied for the job, and based upon a combination of her native intelligence and large vocabulary and blatant flat-out lies about her background, they hired her. And as many of you know, a week or two later, the head of the law firm, the judge, calls her in and says, "You've never been to college, have you?" And the turning that we often, that I think about a lot, is when she confessed, instead of firing her, he sent her to some friends who got her into Brown University. And her life moved on. Here, I find myself thinking about that lie. She flat out lied. And I think in the list there's actually a precept we can have. Listening and speaking from the heart, I vow to take up the way of not speaking falsely. Now, we've played a lot with the ideas of literal and compassionate and absolute, and there's no doubt we need to open ourselves up to all of these. And we need to know when to move in another direction. I think about that lie. But that lie was also informed by the fact that she had a baby to feed. And she had a life to live. And she had some option, and she took it. Now, I don't worry a whole lot about self-esteem. What I worry about is how I never have enough. When we were, we never quite went hungry, but there was a lot of Kraft macaroni and cheese. There was there were, as many of you know, Christmases that only happened because of the firemen. I love fire. There was, and for me, the turns came through that mysterious combination of work and friends and astonishing, unearned good luck. And still, I'm aware of all those realities that came together in a way that allowed me to be here. And yet, there's still some part of me that will never have enough degrees, that will never serve a big enough church, that will never have written enough books. And I just get to live with it. It's part of who I am. As some of my friends feel, they're just deeply, deeply down to the ground, not good enough. What I think is really, really important for us is to get in touch with what the wound is, not to expect one in particular, but to be open, to look with our eyes open, to look with our eyes closed. We do that, and we have invitations, and the precepts themselves then help us along the way. Diane's, who has that same demon, the demons that haunt the those of us who come out of the lowest classes of our culture frequently. And she knows her whole life turned on a violation of a precept. If we confined ourselves, as I was a child, I was told breaking one of the Ten Commandments was just as bad as breaking any of the others. It was apparently a small part of general crowd control to have me believe for a while, at least, that telling a lie was just as bad as murdering somebody. We know reality is more complicated than that. If we're sleep deprived, we just have to open and close our eyes to see reality in two different ways. Melissa pointed us to that other abiding mystery that many of us engage with about the mystery of anger. And of course, that's not, and it's often misunderstood, it's not about rage specifically, it's the entire constellation of aversion that many of us feel. Just if we're resentful, if we notice we're not getting what's ours by right, whatever these things are that fall into that constellation, each of the moments in time that themselves are nothing, but if they become napalm burning into our hearts, fostered and continued, they become the demon that we need to be careful about. And I have all those feelings. I've felt every one of them, but the ones that work for me that haunt me turn more on greed and desire and wanting. It manifests as wanting more books. I have mentioned I have one coming out. We do this. We simply do this. I'm on the sixth week of my newly invented dietary, the consciousness diet, which I will package and offer as a book in a couple of years. If I lose a little weight. What we need to do is open our hearts. We need to find out who it is that we are. And we see that we are many things. We are multitudes. And the precepts, for me, have always been the guide back. At some moment, I need it as a literal rule. Sometimes I have to not lie. Sometimes, in order to save somebody, one's daughter, a lie might be just the right thing. And throughout all of this, knowing that the reason we can see through this and the reason we can act out is that endlessly, endlessly we are open, we are boundless. The possibilities of our lives are at once constrained, at once free. There is no doubt in my heart that each of us, given all the givens of who we are, whatever our genes or our history or the specific circumstances of our lives, are given an opportunity, a mysterious, beautiful, beautiful opportunity. How did Leonard's song go? I fought against the bottle, but I had to do it drunk. There's Dharma for you. Took my diamond to the pawn shop, but that don't make a jump. I know that I'm forgiven, but I don't know how I know. Deep in Sesshin, eyes open, eyes closed, this reality that I don't know. I don't know. I don't trust my inner feelings. Inner feelings come and go. But we sit, we are present, We give our hearts to the practice. We give our hearts to each other. We listen and we watch and we pay attention. And it will all come out in the wash.
So please make yourselves comfortable, and I'm going to recommend again that people behind the fireplace, if you want to come forward, and we'll have our Dharma dialogue.
Talk about the contrived reality reminded me of something that... Can you hear me?
No.
I'm sorry.
Is there a fan on or something?
Yeah.
Oh, we wanted that turned off. I'm so sorry. Yeah. I wondered why you could hear us the other day and you couldn't hear us today.
We said really great things.
You know, it reminds me, there's a great story that D.T. Suzuki tells. He was in a big hall in New York. Some of you know this story. And the windows were open because it was summertime and there was a lot of traffic noise. And he spoke like this. And people in the back said, "I can't hear you." And he said, "Well, that's okay." We don't feel that way, so we really want you to come forward. Thanks, Kate.
Concerning your contrived realities and the problems that brings about, it reminded me of something that happened the week before I came to Sesshin. I spent a week on the Cape with my family, my extended family. We all got together. It was a highly unusual thing for us. But anyway, so we spent some days on the beach, and one of the days that we were there, this family camped out next to us, and they had a bunch of little children, and the three older ones all ran down to the water, but the littlest one stayed behind, so she was very close to where we were. This little, sort of maybe four, whatever age, they have that sweet little round belly that you feel embarrassed about when you're older, but it's lovely on a child. And a little red hair and polka dot pink bathing suit. And she was striking these poses. I mean, it was really, you couldn't help but watch her. She was striking these poses and then lecturing someone and then bringing them over here and showing them how it should be. She had this invisible friend, right? And she spent the whole afternoon with this invisible friend straightening her out. Someone who was weaker than she was, someone who wasn't as knowledgeable as she was, someone who, obviously what had trickled down to her, she kept trickling. And I was really struck by it. I mean, it keeps coming back to me over and over how she had created this bad kid, you know, the wrong kid, and she was the judging voice, and how that's what we do, how we internalize that, and no doubt she would eventually. And like you say, to be suspicious of it, you know, what is that really? And I've been thinking about that in terms of the precepts as well. Particularly the three, of first ceasing from doing evil, and mm-hmm. how if we, that's just stopping, just hearing those voices instead of passing it down, trickling it down. And then the second one, to cultivate every good, which comes out as bearing witness, seeing what that is instead of, you know, that urge to blame someone else. Just get it off of me, not face it. And then from those two, how it's just sort of automatic, thereby saving all beings. Don't have to do anything or know how to do it. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, great. And then Sam after that. Ray?
I found both. Thank you. Very, very, very moving. And what you were talking about speaks to me the essence of Zen, of having no ground to rely on, no right, no wrong. You know, the way we set up sorts of criteria about what's right and then judge ourselves in relationship to it. And sort of like try to have, for me, have precepts that sort of guide my behavior. And come to realize that there really is no sort of guides that of some sort of concepts or constructs that are right and wrong. There just is living life and responding to life. Just a brief example. When I was really young, we were pretty poor. My mother stashed some money, some settlement money, and didn't call the welfare, so we could receive welfare. And I always felt ashamed at the fact that she had been, you know, not been honest with them. And sort of played, you know, saw that the thing about poverty is less not having, but the way it works to have you do things about which you feel shame, guilt, remorse, and all those kinds of things that you've learned from our culture, you know, to feel about the things that we do. And so being able to not be so hard on ourselves, at least for me, not be so hard on ourselves, for the kind of internal judges and things that I continually say, oh, there's a right way, oh, there's a wrong way, I shouldn't do this, I shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. To be able to let go of that and settle into something deeper and much more fundamental.
Thank you. So Sam, you had your hand up?
I could really relate to what James was talking about. From a little different way, my dad was the first person in his family to ever go to college. My grandparents worked in a textile mill, and I was brought up, there was always food on the table. But there wasn't always, we never relied on the firemen at Christmas, but sometimes we got one thing. And poverty, you know, lack of money isn't all that poverty is about. I think that there's also a spiritual poverty that even people with almost nothing have. It's not the way I wanted to say it. That people with almost nothing have a internal or a thing sometimes where they're not spiritually poor, where there's something internal that is their life and the way they relate that isn't always just based on the commandments. We were not, I did not come from any kind of, you know, these are the rules. We were always open to question and to look at, you know, what you saw, and to think about things. But I think my real point is that I can relate to both sides.
Yeah.
You know, I can see the that lower class, so-called lower class existence and living from meal to meal. And I can also see the middle class. I went to college, to high school with kids who were well off. And could see a real difference. And sometimes the people that had the money also seemed to have less going on internally.
Sam, I think you're making a really important point here. Thank you so much. I think there's so much that we can get caught in about it's actually another contrivance for the self, mm-hmm. in a way. It reminds me of the Monty Python skit where somebody says, "I grew up so poor that you think that was poor. I grew up, we had a box. You had a box. Wow, we lived in a hole in the ground." Yeah, it just goes on and on forever. Because, you know, you had a paper bag. As James was talking, it threw me back into a similar reflection for you, Sam. You know, my parents had nothing. And I was lucky when I got older that my father suddenly became a business success in selling fruit and vegetables. But my brother was the first person in the family to go to college, that generation. And, you know, I can think of shameful things. I remember, you know, that my mother would do. I was so embarrassed. She was doing it from that same mentality of not enough. The thing that occurs to me about all this is that they're all true. You know, that everybody's suffering. I think you pointed to this, James, that everybody's suffering has a truth in it that needs to be met and faced and then not clung to anymore. I bow to Monty Python because it makes me laugh a lot. Because it is what we all do. It's so great. And I could feel myself doing it. No, me too. I was poor. Come on. And I remember when I worked in the inner city for a number of years teaching meditation to people, I went in with an expectation that they would be like my grandparents in terms of the same, you know, not enough quality. And it was a range over the board. There were people who had come from every conceivable place. And some of them had extreme low self-esteem. They just did. And actually, after 8 weeks, we did this measurement. Their self-esteem measures went up. You know, that was like, whoa, look at us. Meditation works. That's another story. But in the middle class classes, the people in the middle class started with self-esteem way higher and made a much smaller increase.
I thought that was reduced.
No. I mean, you'd think that with all of our complaining, you would think that. But it really, in the general, you know, if you mix all the numbers together and go for the medium, people, and there's even evidence, we'll go to Laura.
Hopefully to James.
Yeah, and then to James. That there's a part of the brain called a telomere that predicts longer and healthier life, and it's been associated with higher income. Like if you came from a background where you were well-fed and well-educated, your telomeres are longer, and there's no way to correct it, except they should say meditation corrects it. Anyway, over to James.
Well, yeah. And I would like to, I mean, the danger of my telling poverty stories is that we start doing the paper bag thing.
Yeah.
And the invitation that I really hoped to pull us toward, as valuable as it is to see our stories, is that we have wounds. They're a little different for each of us. I feel gifted in some ways from my background and then my current lifestyle. I get like a little millimeter of distance, which I think makes me usually more helpful. But all of us, whether it's self-esteem, whether it's grasping, whatever there must be 10 million other variations on the human condition. The invite for us on the whatever day of Sesshin this is, when we can close our eyes and start dreaming instantly, is to witness this, whatever the story we like is, and see the storiness of it, as well as allowing the realities that create the story. And for me, that comes back to, and I hope that would be for us also, the touchstone throughout. Is precept way. I love that you brought up the three pure precepts. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm constantly informed by, if you can't do anything else, well, fucking stop hurting people. Yeah. And if you can, you know, be kind. Yeah. And although you said be attentive, I thought that was even better.
Yeah.
And then we get to move into the realm, you know. If we're lucky, the first is good enough.
Yeah.
And I shut up. I think Laura wanted to say something.
Well, Laura did, and there's somebody. Oh, I saw Maddie's hand. James, did you raise your hand? Oh, everybody on this row. I saw Willie, Alan, and Carolyn. All right, probably some others. Let's see what we can do. Let's go to Laura.
And the first one is a teaching from Eckhart Tolle, who says, where there's anger, there's always fear underneath. And when I first heard this several years ago, I was quite skeptical. It was a new concept to me, and I thought, well, what? And I started working with it and reflecting on it, and over time, I found that for me, that's absolutely true. And so when I do feel angry, I almost automatically now look for the fear. Usually I can find it. The fear is not, fear is also very powerful and not a pleasant emotion. But I think it's less corrosive than anger, especially because it's true. And it allows us to be more forgiving to other people around us, which allows us to unburden ourselves from that, and then bring that same compassion to ourselves around the fear. And also ask ourselves, is this really true? Is my fear based on something true? So in any case, that's one that I want to share. And the other one is one that I've mentioned before. And so forgive me if you've heard me say this before, but it's a teaching from the Zen teacher, Richard Clark. I heard him say numerous times that we're always doing the best that we can. And I think this is extremely logical because, as he used to say, if we could have done better, clearly we would have. You know, he'd say, I should never have, you know, blown my talk yesterday. Well, yeah, but apparently if I could have done better, I wouldn't have. So with what resources I had at the moment, you know, 3 hours sleep, not enough food, feeling fearful about something or other that someone said to me, or whatever it is, that was apparently the best I could do. So I think it's, again, a very compassionate way of looking at ourselves and also others. Others are also doing the best that they can. So here we are all struggling together. The point is, though, that it's not that we are kind of destined always to do only this well, because through things like meditation, we can, and the precepts, we can learn to do better.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Carolyn, did you have your hand up?
Oh, yeah. I'm new to the precepts because I just took
them. Can you hear Carolyn?
No.
I hope you can hear me because I can't talk very loud unless I...
could stand up.
Why don't you stand up?
Unless you don't want to.
She's saying she's new to the precepts. We'll do a little simultaneous translation.
Okay, I'll try to project. I don't remember taking the precepts, actually. I remember a few things, like water being scattered and... someone straightening out the back of the daksu, which was very nice. I think that was Bodhisattva Jitran. But I had written down things down. But for some reason, I didn't write down the first six. I don't know why. So, I'm never having in my 63 years spoken in public about anything remotely personal. My mind went completely blank, and I mean, I thought, oh, this is good because the person on my right is going to talk. He had such elegant, long things to say. That should give me time. My mind was actually completely blank and filled with this anxiety, and I felt like I was sitting on the edge of a cliff and something had to come out of my mouth. And I guess things came out of my mouth, because afterwards people were really nice and they all said, oh, thank you. And I thought, really? I guess I must have taken my precepts. And then I remember a long conversation about mystery novels, which apparently was something I said.
I was really worried you had promised never to read a mystery novel.
That was wounding.
So I went from that to having to do a job for which, of course, I'm not prepared. And the reason I'm not prepared is because I never pay attention. And I didn't even know it. I didn't know what a dawn was. I didn't even know what an Eno was. I just knew that if Diane asked you to do something, you said yes.
She's putting her thumbs up.
Carol, you just described the secret of Zen training.
Yeah. Forget about what we said in our talks.
So I asked, James, well, what am I supposed to do? And I think I speak for all of us when I sincerely hope he was joking. He said, well, you just watch and learn, and then you try it yourself. Kind of like going through medical school.
It's so true.
There's a saying, see one, do one, teach one. That's right.
So I began trying to pay attention. And that's when I realized that I really never had paid attention, that not paying attention was exactly the way I've lived my life. And I began to get into a state, because it was so incredibly overwhelming. I mean, there's when you look for someone in the doorway and you're supposed to clap, but you have to remember after that that you're supposed to do this. I just got myself into this state where I thought, is this some kind of reality TV show like in Survivor, and the person who has a breakdown first seems to leave or something? And then I happened to be on one of those days where you don't get chosen for Doksan, right? I mean, it happens, right? And so the anxiety was building, and my own personal demons, not perhaps too unlike Mike's, but everybody dislikes me because there's something innately disgusting about me, and I don't belong. I was dealing with these, with the precepts, and the precepts have helped me I understand that feeling disgusting is an empty thing. But you know, you can bring that into a room and you can make it happen. So you can make your own karma right out of it. And belonging, I know that we all belong wherever we are. That's where we are. That's where we belong. But then I went up to a Dokusan line. Alan came down and caught me. And I sat in the Dokusan line. And then he turned around and said, sorry. And the Dokusan line. So I suddenly felt tremendously relieved. Just as I thought. I am disgusting. I don't belong. So I went downstairs and I sat down and I thought, now why am I so happy about this? How could anyone be happy about this? This isn't right. And a voice said to me, oh, come on, Carol. They surely have lots of other inmates to see besides you. Which sounded strange. And then what happened is that I noticed everybody supporting me all around me in ways that I can't really explain. They were all there beside me and around me and going through the rest of the day. And you know, I felt mad because I couldn't fall back into my hole. It's like it closed off, and it was like the reality of the Sangha being a refuge slammed shut that door, and I was mad. And then that mad feeling somehow turned around. And it became this sort of determination, is all I can explain. Mm-hmm. Anyway, as I was walking today, I remembered a kind of half daydream fantasy I had a couple days ago that kind of created in my mind. And I was on a bus, and it was packed with people. And we're going along, and suddenly the bus stops. And the whole time I'm having this fantasy, there's another voice saying, come on, get on with it, stop wasting time. But, you know, the person in the fantasy kept slowing things down. But anyway, the bus stopped, and the driver got off. And I was standing there next to the driver, and everyone else is perfectly happy sitting. And I saw a big timer ticking. And I knew I had to get everybody off that bus. And so that's what I did, and I was pretty amazed that they did what I told them to do. They actually started getting up and moving slowly off the bus. I remember what they looked like, the middle-aged couples and the tall, skinny man with white hair and all the students. And I wanted to be perfectly calm so that nothing would get disturbed, and I kept ushering them up. And there's this woman with a baby at the back. And you know how it is when you have a baby, you got your diaper bag and the bottles, and she's jumping things all over, and the time was running out. And finally, I rushed to the back, and I grabbed the baby, and I just pushed the woman in front of me off the bus and handed her the baby, and then I knew exactly what I had to do. And I took a flying leap through the air, did a flip, and landed outside. And I felt, and I feel, fantastic.
Wow, thank you. So we had about 20 people with their hands up and not so much time left. Let's reboot, just raising your hand if you want to add something to our conversation. So I see Willie and Jeremy and Julie. Okay, so Willie?
I hate to follow up after that.
Yeah.
But sure.
Good.
there's that precept there about not misusing the Dharma assets. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me that our backgrounds, our childhoods, our poverty, or not, those of us who didn't get poverty and all the rest of that, whatever we got are really just our Dharma assets. Mm-hmm. And to make a big deal about them or to not make a big deal about them is to misuse them. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Jeremy.
So, thank you, actually, everybody, because this is the track record for these Dharma dialogues is just unbelievable. I get so much out of them. And one of the major themes that is coming up for me is the one of judgment. And I really appreciated the way, I think it was James, you said the precepts can guide you back. And I'm going to have to chew on that. Actually, I might need some help from you guys, because for me, it's automatically, you know, a win. You know, it's just another truncheon. And so this judgment trip is a big part of my head. And there have been occasional moments in my life when, you know, I've been doing something and, you know, typically I'll be able to work on something for a while and I have to drop it and run away, because I get completely overwhelmed with that noise. And there have been a couple of moments in my life when I've been able to turn towards it and say, all right, you son of a bitch, what do you want? What would do it? And silence. Total silence. And I've had these lucid moments of getting an insight into the wild inconsistency of these judging voices. And what it helps me to realize when I can get there, which is not as often as I'd like, but there's nothing to it. That's, and more than that, it's not like I realize that and then it stops. I realize that and then I just don't give a shit. And it keeps going. And that's fine, because that's what it does. It judges. That's your job. You're a judge. Sit in the corner and judge, you bastard, while I get on with my life.
Thank you.
Jeremy, I just want to highlight one of the things you're saying, of this rousing of the energy, that there is sometimes when we, it's not just, well, whatever, and I'll just go back to my breath, and, you know, but there is something about saying, no, this is my life. I choose, I grab the baby, I do a flip in the air, you know, whatever it is, but I just want to point to that rousing of energy. We could call it anger, we could call it many different things, but there, it is to me a part of practice and a part of meeting the onslaught, and that when we come forward in that way, the judge can go on. We are not fighting the judge. Fighting the judge, we always lose. But there is that point where we allow the judge to be the judge. We give up that endless self-improvement project and acknowledge it, and we move forward. So thank you for saying that.
Thank you. And our last, Julie.
Yeah, this is on the theme of really appreciating the support of the Sangha. In the service, we had a special dedication to Lori Guo, my sister. And I have to, we get so often at the tragicomic here. I'll have to tell you how that got on the list. Friday night, said we could add, you know, Dr. James, if we want to add people. And what went through my head was, I came into Sangha with a heavy heart. My sister's had metastatic breast cancer for 4 years. She's found out last week she's at the end of chemotherapy. She's starting palliative care. I'm going out there soon to be with her. And I thought, I could put Lori on the list. But you know, yeah, she's had the cancer, and yeah, she's at the end of the chemo, and yeah, she's on palliative care. But she really isn't dying yet, so I shouldn't take the time of the Sangha for this. And this came up because my own background was, you have enough. You should be happy with what you have. You shouldn't ask for more. You shouldn't ask for help. And so this, you know, okay. Just so she's not dying yet, get with it, Julie. Put her name on the list. You can ask for this. You know, it's tragicomic what we put ourselves through on those stories.
Thank you.
Thank you. Perfect
and,
end.
Yeah. Thank you for that gift to us.
Yeah, exactly. I just want to say that these Dharma dialogues have been awesome. And not because of what people have said, but the way people have stepped forward and shared your truths with, you know, your truths, well, that's a problematic phrase, shared your hearts. Mm-hmm. Almost like the words aren't so important. But some spirit has come through, and you know, Carolyn, you just touched me so much with every word you said, and I don't think I could repeat what you said. But there was something about the presence of honesty.
I mean, I really repeat the baby part.
Yeah, the baby part I could repeat. David just repeated it. So just to know that this practice is not about wallowing in our difficulties. It's about giving voice to what's here, and what shines forth is the light, always. So that's really important. We have many ways. We're so talented at hiding out and running away, battling the judge endlessly, and it never works out. We're good at that. This is a different enterprise. And I just want to read two lines from Leonard Cohen before I begin. Because this is another thing he says in this same poem, song. I closed the book of longing, and I do what I am told. So please do what Diane says.